Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and compared to other Ivy League schools, Columbia University says it is far too cramped on its main campus in Morningside Heights. In order to compete and retain its world-class university status, Columbia argues it needs to expand. If the university of the past could concentrate on history and English literature, now it has to add things like neuroscience and mind-brain behavior to remain at the forefront of modern thought. And that takes space. Specifically, Columbia hopes it will take about 17 or 18 acres in the Manhattanville section of West Harlem, an area bigger than the entire current main campus, the one you enter at 116th Street. With that, they argue, will come 6,000 permanent new jobs. But that much land acquisition anywhere in Manhattan is bound to be fraught with competing interests, and so it is with this former manufacturing zone from roughly 125th to 132nd Streets, from Broadway west to 12th Avenue, even though not much appears to be going on there now compared to other parts of the city. Only a few hundred people live there, and commercial life is sparse, tending toward the auto repair and self-storage warehouses that moved in when the manufacturing base moved out. Still, there are definitely issues. The debate begins with the name of the neighborhood, Manhattanville or Harlem, and continues from there into questions of affordable housing, eminent domain, hazardous research materials, and competing visions of the future of New York. By way of full disclosure, I got my master's degree at Columbia and taught there as an adjunct for 3 years. With me now to argue for the expansion and to talk about a few other things if we have time is the president of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger. President Bollinger, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Why does Columbia need an additional campus bigger than its main campus?
Right. 100 years ago, Seth Lowe was the president of Columbia and realized that Midtown, where Columbia had relocated after being around Wall Street 100 years before that, was too small and moved to Morningside Heights. And this was at the turn of the 20th century. And just in the decades ahead, Columbia, as other major universities, became the universities we know of today, places of extraordinary creativity that have really undergirded the economic and other success of the United States. That really has now been used up, and it's critical that Columbia have more space for the knowledge that needs to be discovered over the next several decades. So it's really an imperative that Columbia find the space to do what it is a great research university can do.
Columbia wants this for its own reasons, but part of your argument seems to be what's good for Columbia is good for the city. How much is that at the heart of your argument?
It's crucial. I mean, I think you're exactly right. It is a claim that urban areas, major cities, are the places that people are increasingly gravitating to. They are the dynamic parts of a modern society. And the key element of great cities is a sort of institutions of high creativity, and universities are those.
I took the walking tour that the school offers to members of the media, and one of the main points seems to be that this is not brownstone Harlem. So for people
right.
not familiar with the neighborhood, they hear Columbia expanding into Harlem. They think Stryver's Row. They think
right.
125th Street, economic zone. This is a sparse, underutilized former manufacturing zone where not many people live or work. And Columbia, you argue, is offering something much better than what's there now.
Exactly. I mean, I came to Columbia with my wife from the West Coast, from Oregon, in 1968. And I know the collision of values that played themselves out on the Columbia campus in that year. It was a kind of Robert Moses versus Jane Jacobs debate that really a number of places like Columbia experienced the collision. So I'm very aware of that. When I started 5 years ago, I knew, as I said before, that Columbia had to have more space in order to be the great university that it can be. For a great city in the decades ahead. I knew we had to find space. And yet we had to do it in a way that was different from how it had been done 100 years ago. We can't have a gated community. We can't have buildings that are not welcoming to people on the street. We can't close off streets. Rather, we have to animate life on the streets. We have to engage the community in this. We have to be part of a revitalization of the area. That's been the design.
For people who don't know the history, 1968 was not just the year of a student anti-war uprising at Columbia, but a related community uprising after the school tried to take land in the community for a new gymnasium. So you're saying you've learned lessons from Columbia's experience of 1968 and you're applying them?
Absolutely. I mean, from the beginning, my feeling was we need to embrace where we live. And we live in Upper Manhattan, we live in Harlem, and we want to be part of that community. My feeling is, in all honesty, I want Harlem, and we want Harlem to remain Harlem. We want to be part of the communities in ways that you can help people have better lives. That's in part by having jobs and job training, but it's also by having retail at the ground level and public spaces and parks and an advocate for things that people want.
Lee Bollinger, the president of Columbia University, my guest on WNYC, as we talk about what Columbia calls its Manhattanville campus expansion plans. Our lines are already lighting up, so for those of you who don't have us on your speed dial, it's 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, if you want to speak to Lee Bollinger this morning, or email Brian Lehrershow at WNYC.org. We'll get to your calls in a few minutes. There is a competing vision put forth by the community board. This was from last year. I don't know if this exact vision is still active, but they said Columbia could expand into much of the space you want, but existing housing and businesses could remain in a mixed-use environment, and affordable housing would be expanded under their plan, not diminished. Could you go for that kind of mixed-use compromise to accommodate the people who do live and work there today?
There is a plan that some people have proposed, and this is not exactly an official plan, but it's called the 197A, and it basically is on a premise that light manufacturing can continue or return to the area. One of the buildings in the area is Studebaker Building, which is we own it now, and we will preserve it because it's a building of some significance. I like to say that Studebakers were made there some years ago. I can assure you Studebakers will never be made in that building again. The point is that light manufacturing is not where the economy of New York City or other cities is going. It's just not where it is.
But that's a large argument to make, because what you're arguing in support of your desired campus is the requirement to give up on any kind of manufacturing future for New York City rather than trying to reinvigorate the manufacturing sector in those parts of land around the city where we still theoretically could do that.
It's not realistic, and it won't help the people who live there to think that or to act on a policy that manufacturing will return. It's just not going to happen. And indeed, for several decades, people in the Harlem area have tried to figure out how to develop this small area we call Manhattanville in West Harlem, and nothing has happened. So either it will languish and jobs will continue to decline, or a luxury condominium group will come in and put them. Then that won't be good for the surrounding communities. Or a great university with all that it can offer people in health and education and help with housing and jobs really can make a huge difference in the lives of people around there.
Now put on your headphones. We're going to start taking some of our many phone calls for Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia University. And Anne on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anne.
Hi, my name is Anne Whitman, and I'm the owner of Hudson Moving and Storage. My family owns two buildings on Broadway that are historic. My building is on the National Register. I am a state and certified woman business enterprise. I have 100% women and minority employees. And I would just like to say that I think that the community is not anti-Columbia. We welcome Columbia to our area, but we think the plan needs some more balance. And the balance that's needed is that Columbia should work within the 197A plan. They have more than enough room to do their brain study and their work. But I hear Mr. Bollinger talking about embracing the community, and he likes extraordinary creativity. I invite Mr. Bollinger to come to a walking tour that I could take him on and show him some extraordinary creativity that's taking place in Manhattanville. I would like to also stand up against the use of eminent domain for a single private developer in 17 acres. That's twice the size of the World Trade Center. I think that's a terrible abuse of government power. And you've even heard right out of Mr. Bollinger's mouth this morning that he wants to build retail on the sidewalks. And what he really wants to do is use his tax-exempt status to benefit a private institution at taxpayer expense. The plan needs more balance. There shouldn't be a single developer.
And what's the creativity that you're talking about that would disappear under the Columbia plan?
Well, Manhattanville is an artist community. Because of the cost down in Union Square, artists look for inexpensive space. There is a very vibrant and diverse artist community. In my building, for example, we have gilding, carving, restoration of investment quality antiques. We work in very high end with very high end artisans, and there are many that you cannot, if you just went up and down the streets, you wouldn't even know that this stuff is going on inside the building.
All right, let me jump in and get a response. President Bollinger, this raises a number of issues. One of them certainly is affordable housing for artists or anyone else. This Columbia plan would put tremendous additional property value pressure on the whole community.
Ms. Whitman has raised a number of issues. Let me take them, I guess. My wife is an artist, has a studio in the Manhattanville area. We know the area well. The School of the Arts of Columbia will be one of the first institutions of Columbia to move there. There will be opportunities for collaboration with local artists, with local art institutions. This should be a fabulous combination of interests. Secondly, there's no interest on the part of Columbia in trying to make money out of the retail stores that will be along 125th Street or along Broadway. This is really to provide community opportunities for people in the area to set up.
If a low-income artist can afford a studio there or to live there, how would the School of the Arts at Columbia benefit them? That would be more exclusively for students and university community people, wouldn't it?
There will be galleries, there will be space for theater, there will be shared opportunities for classes in arts. I mean, this is absolutely something that will benefit people who are in the arts.
On the affordable housing
right.
I read that you're likely to add affordable housing as part of a community benefits agreement with the neighborhood that's being negotiated, but you're holding it back as a bargaining chip. Where does that stand?
The city has set up a unique process for us to work through as this is developed. And that process says we can only talk to and negotiate with a local development corporation that has been set up by the community board. We have now had almost three meetings with the local community group. And that's going very well. And one of the things on the table clearly will be affordable housing. And I can say, and I've said this many times publicly, we want to do our part as an institution with helping with affordable housing, working with the city. And we will do that.
And I want to take up the topic of eminent domain.
Right.
After this break.
Okay.
As we continue.
Wonderful.
With the president of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the president of Columbia University, Lee Bollinger. We're talking primarily about Columbia's planned expansion into the Manhattanville section of West Harlem. very controversial in some parts of the neighborhood. It certainly has lit up our phones, which are full at 212-433-WNYC. Our inbox, never full, Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. Eminent domain. The caller raised it, asking the government to force people to move on your behalf. Now, that may be legal for private development under some circumstances, according to the Supreme Court recently, but it is considered extremely offensive and a bullying tactic by many. Will you take eminent domain off the table?
No, this is a complicated subject, so let me try to reduce this as quickly as I can. First of all, eminent domain is itself part of our constitutional system to help achieve public purposes. And if you want to build a national park and private property stands in the way, it's very important for the collective good that we be able to have eminent domain. Columbia is a nonprofit public institution. It's not a private developer. We're not trying to make money. And if a party stands in the way of developing the neuroscience work, which may actually find a cure to Alzheimer's, the second gene to Alzheimer's was just discovered by Columbia scientists. That is a proper use of eminent domain.
But let me just challenge you on that for a second, because you just call Columbia a public institution.
Yes.
SUNY is a public institution. The railroad is a public institution. Columbia is a private institution, isn't it? A not-for-profit private institution.
It's a not-for-profit, but it's a public institution in the sense that it is not in what we do for profit. And we are funded by the federal government to do research on issues like matters like Alzheimer's. We do things in terms of educating people in all kinds of areas. We have a health system that serves many, many thousands of people, including people in the Harlem area. We staff Harlem Hospital. This is, by any definition, an institution that is sponsored by the state to serve public purposes. But the last thing I want to say, Brian, is that we have no interest in using and will not use eminent domain against individuals. We're not going to be evicting the small number of people who actually live there from their homes. There are 15 years before Columbia would have any interest in developing the areas where the few people actually live. And in that 15-year period, it is absolutely certain that we can work with them to have a better life than they have now.
Columbia will get most of this land in any case. You've made deals with most owners already, as I understand it.
That's correct.
So why not allow the few who really want to remain with their homes or businesses to do so?
It would be, first of all, the people who own the property that we do not own, and it's now a very small number, fortunately, do not live in Harlem. They are not part of the Harlem community. I mean, let's be completely frank about this. This is being utilized as an emotional kind of issue to draw upon by a few people to try to oppose Columbia.
But the things I read about in the Daily News the other day, for example, is a building at 602 West 132nd Street, which, you know, the city is providing low-income ownership housing, sweat equity housing. People can buy those units for $250 after they put in the sweat equity. There's that storage place that's put the big no eminent domain sign up on its building that people see as they ride the number one train past there. I mean, they're there. They're not outsiders, right?
For those people, as I said a moment ago, for those people who live there, and it's a very small number, it's one of the really unusual things about this 18-acre area, we are not going to be evicting those individuals from those places. For 15 years before Columbia has any interest in developing, this is a long-term process that we're initiating. For 15 years, people can continue to live there, and in the meantime, we will be working with them to try to make sure that their lives are better than they are now. I mean, that's the promise that we've made. With respect to people who might own a piece of property that would make it impossible to develop a neuroscience initiative, I have very little sympathy, actually. They're in it for the profit, not for their own family purposes.
They're using it to negotiate to get
Absolutely.
The best deal from Columbia. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
These are the outsiders you're talking about?
That's correct.
Michael in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hello, Michael.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I wrote the book Harlem Lost and Found, an Architecture and Social History, and I was educated in the Historic Preservation Program at Columbia, the oldest in the nation. And, you know, since I still owe Columbia $40,000, I do not think of them as a public, free, not-for-profit entity. I mean, all of those things that President Bollinger says that Columbia does, they do for money. And for Columbia to be talking about destroying buildings which are listed on the National Register of Historic Places just seems to me to be a wrong-headed thing. And furthermore, to be suggesting that employers who employ people who work and have real jobs in our community and suggest frivolously that somehow or another, because the people who own the building don't live there, that somehow this is not a meaningful purpose in our community is just wrong. And sure, Columbia might find a cure for cancer or Alzheimer's or anything, but this is the same kind of arrogance that we experienced in 1968. To suggest that this is an either-or proposition, we were told in 1968 that we had to have the gym with separate, unequal facilities in our park, and that there was no way that we could contest that. And now we're told that the only way that Columbia can expand is that these few people who want to continue and have their participation in the community, whether living here or whether having businesses here, that you have to get out or else we're going to take you by eminent domain. That is a wrong, wrong way for an entity like Columbia to operate when we're saying we want to work with you, but we don't want to have our businesses or our homes, which we've had for generations, taken away from us.
And let me get a response, Michael. President Bollinger,
I very much
hear the emotion as well as the intellectual argument.
I very much appreciate the sense in which he is expressing this, but let me be very direct in trying to respond. First of all, I have not said we are using eminent domain. I've said we have not taken it off the table. Very important. We have not decided, and we hope very much not to use it. Secondly,
though you did just say in your previous answer, in effect, we will use eminent domain if we can if we have to evict those people, use the word evict, in 15 years.
I said what I said was that for 15 years, we have no interest at all in evicting anyone from anything. And it's clear that within that time, we can work with those individuals to better their lives. And that's my commitment to them personally. But I think it's, you know, one has to step back. It's very easy to think that this is a large institution with only acting for its own interests, not for a larger good, and that it will be doing things to the community that are not good. But if one thinks about where is the future of the city going, and if you live in that area, what do you want most of all? And I think you want things like real job opportunities that are very good jobs. And this will create 6,000 net new jobs from what is there now. And they're very good jobs with a great institution. I would want health benefits. I would want the opportunity to receive treatment for disease. And we do that. And that's the kind of thing that a Columbia can expand. I would want my children to be able to be in after-school programs that Columbia might have, or to be in a school that we've committed to doing with the city, a public high school. These are the kinds of things that really will be an enormous benefit to the people around.
All subject to negotiation with the community board in this community benefits agreement.
That's correct.
What's the deal with the name, by the way? You want it known as Columbia's Manhattanville Project. Others are offended that you're taking the Harlem out of Harlem. Why did you?
I think this is a side issue. I mean, I think there's a bigger issue, which I'll speak to. We have called this from the beginning Manhattanville and West Harlem. It's a historic name for the area, and we thought we were respectful of the history of the particular area.
You're saying Manhattanville in West Harlem.
That's right.
And people may not know that there's the Manhattanville Housing Project
that's
there.
Right.
There is a Manhattanville post office right there. So it's there.
That's right.
But it's Harlem. Harlem, in a way, would seem to be a better brand name unless you're avoiding it.
Yeah. So the point is that from the beginning, the idea of expanding the university into this area was to embrace being part of Harlem. I mean, that's the goal, and that's the huge challenge that we have. We want to preserve Harlem as Harlem. I think the issue that people are thinking of is we want Harlem to stay Harlem.
So who
we
cares
want
about
that too.
Manhattanville? Why not just call it the Columbia campus in West Harlem?
I'm delighted to do that. I mean, it's not an issue. It's just that from the beginning, we talked to community people, and we had a community advisory board. And the idea was respect the particular history of this small area.
Corey in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with the president of Columbia, Lee Bollinger.
Hi, President. As a parent of two current Columbia College students, I find it a little troubling that the university is not more effectively making its case to the public in a way that, you know, would get this thing finished, which should be a slam dunk. I mean, the Yankees got their stadium. They're already constructing it on a public park, no problem. Every other hospital that's providing a public service to the city, even though they are private, gets whatever they need immediately. And somehow or other, this thing seems to be in sort of a defensive mode.
You want to give them PR advice?
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe the university needs something a little bit more than like oral argument on this point. Maybe a little bit more out front and getting across to the community how important the university is to the city.
Right. So let me just say, first of all, we're delighted to have your two children. Secondly, remember what I alluded to before. The city has set up a very unique, special process for this to go through. And we are really precluded from negotiating with anybody else in the community except this local development corporation. And that local development corporation has taken a long time to set up. It's 18 people representing different parts of the various communities, from environment to arts to housing and so on. We've been waiting for this to happen. It's now happened. We've had a couple of meetings. Obviously, there's a negotiating element to this because we're trying to develop a community benefits agreement. I am confident that we will do that. But we are not in a position where we can simply go to people in the community that we identify and say, we will agree to do this in return for your support.
And you also do have, and maybe it doesn't come out in the press or in this discussion, because we're focusing on the controversies, you have a lot of people in the community who are supporting it.
It is very important to realize this. And it's very important to realize the political figures, the representatives, are in favor. Mayor strongly supported this in his State of the City speech in January. Scott Stringer, the borough president, expressed support. Charlie Rangel has expressed public support. Keith Jackson. I mean, I think you're right, the caller, that there is a sense in which this is a great thing for the surrounding communities and for the city, and that it will be increasingly realized as we can go through this process that the city has set up.
One other thing about this plan. Some people don't like the idea of having a level 3, as it's called, biohazards research facility in such a densely populated area. Are you planning one?
Again, this is a kind of myth. I mean, the fundamental argument that some people raise is that very dangerous kinds of research will go on there, which will be a danger to the surrounding communities. That's simply not the case.
You have one other such facility. Where is that?
Well, we have, I mean, the research at the medical center has a number of, I mean, we look into viruses and so on, that because it's part of the great thing that a university can do to protect the public by doing this kind of research.
So some people consider this, you know, a possible terrorism threat or a possible environmental accident threat. You're just saying, no, it's not?
This is just not realistic. I mean, There are risks in lots of things. I mean, but this is not something people should worry about.
While you're here, we have a few more minutes. Let me ask you about some other things.
Sure.
You're a big proponent of affirmative action.
Yes.
You were involved in the landmark Supreme Court case a few years ago.
Yes.
When you were president of the University of Michigan. Now, voters in Michigan have banned affirmative action at the campus, and the new John Roberts Supreme Court may make the practice even more restrictive. Are you still following that?
Yes, I am still following it. Look, I think this is a major crossroads for us in this country, and I think it's whether the sensibilities of Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, the great Supreme Court case that ended desegregation in the United States, but did more. It really set the United States on a course of trying to deal with race relations and racism in a way that the country can be incredibly proud of. And 50 years now after Brown, my concern is that we are slipping away from this very great national effort to deal with race in America. And I must say the recent vote in Michigan was a deep disappointment to people, and I worry very much about our losing our energy for this critical issue.
Should groups other than African Americans be included in the same breath and the same benefits given the unique history of descendants of slaves in the United States?
I mean, this is obviously, again, a complicated question, a very good one. You know, traditionally, we have thought with respect to affirmative action and race issues, those groups who have suffered active and invidious discrimination, and especially legal discrimination in the United States, we really have to repair that damage. And the groups that have been included in that, of course, are African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans.
I gather Columbia is out to raise $4 billion. Are you really on a $4 billion fundraising campaign?
I know it sounds like a great deal. And, of course, the caller a few minutes ago noted the tuition that's charged. Very important to realize that the education that a Columbia provides, we charge only about half of what it actually costs to deliver that education. Universities are part of the great achievement of America, as I begin by saying. I mean, this Columbia is where the genetic revolution actually started. It is one of the places where plate tectonics was understood. FM radio was invented at
what's the good of
Columbia.
That?
Exactly. So we really want to preserve these great institutions, and it takes resources.
You're a free speech expert, scholar, First Amendment scholar, and Columbia has had its share of free speech controversies on your watch over the Minutemen speaking on campus and Ahmadinejad denied and conflict between some Jewish students and some pro-Palestinian faculty. I don't want to rehash those old controversies, some of which we've spoken about before, but have you grown, have you changed during this time as a leader in your approach to setting free speech policy?
Well, I would love to talk about each of those in depth because I think they deserve it. And the question is, to me personally, have I changed? I have thought about free speech in the United States all of my professional life. I am deeply intrigued by the commitment that this country has made to extraordinary protection of free speech, and I am fully supportive of that course. I have confronted these issues in a campus context for 30 years and believe in the basic ideas that students have the right to invite anybody they want. Universities, faculty, administration cannot politicize the institution. Our free speech is more restricted, actually, than the students. I believe deeply that speech cannot be interrupted. I believe deeply in the right of protest. You know, these are very difficult
things
to balance.
Into conflict.
Absolutely.
Some people are concerned that the people who disrupted the Minuteman speech will not be punished severely enough. Has that punishment been decided on yet?
Under established Columbia policy, but also under federal law, I simply am forbidden from talking about disciplinary cases, and that would be true of any president of any university.
So. I'm curious what you think about the effect of the internet, especially the user-generated internet like blogs and YouTube and everything, on free speech in America or on our democracy. Is this something you've thought about?
A lot. I think it's too early to tell. whether this is going to be the beginning of a kind of Athenaean forum that will be democracy at its height, or whether it will be the beginning of a kind of Babel in a country where society will spin apart because we just can't find a coherent sort of place to talk. I'm very much inclined towards the former view. I generally believe that more speech is better.
What do you think are the signs that it could go one way or the other?
Well, I think the hardening of public debate and the taking advantage, the indulging of one's personal hatreds. I mean, we all like to go to where we feel most comfortable, and we like to reinforce our sense that we're right. And I think a number of places, I think the O'Reilly factor is not a healthy thing for American society. And I think that plays itself out in a number of contexts. That worries me.
Is there policy regarding the Internet that would help make it an Athenian center rather than a Babel?
It's very interesting. You know, the broadcasting, radio and TV have been highly regulated, actually, since their origins when this radio was set up in the 1920s, I think. From that point until today, radio and TV are rather extensively regulated in the public interest by a federal agency, the Federal Communications Commission. We've had a fairness doctrine, an equal time provision, a serve the public interest requirement. None of that applies to the Internet. Internet is more like the print media, and that's the way it will be treated, and I'm in favor of that.
You're in favor of lack of regulation.
That's correct, yes.
How about its effect on education? I have a friend who's an art history professor at another university, and she prohibits her students from using the Internet for research because she says they need to look at books and use libraries. And this professor is in her 30s.
Yeah. Well, I teach a course. I teach an undergraduate course in freedom of speech and press, 150 students in the class. I do not forbid them from looking at the Internet. On the other hand, I call on them in class. They have to respond. They have to. I think the Internet is a source of incredible wealth of knowledge. I think it's also a great risk and a danger, and we have to figure out ways to get the best out of it.
Wouldn't the lack of regulation that you just advocate help bring about Babel rather than Athens?
There's just no way to figure out how to regulate it for the ends that we would agree we want. I mean, that's the problem. We could do that in a way with radio and TV, but the Internet is more like the classic come to the forum, express your views, and we'll see what happens.
The president of Columbia University and professor of, what's that course you teach?
Freedom of Speech and Press.
Lee Bollinger, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will look at the underlying causes of that horrible fire in the Bronx that took the lives of 8 children and 1 grown-up last night. Stay with us.